The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So for this evening's talk, I want to discuss a concept and principle which is very key to the teachings of the Buddha. And it's so kind of embedded in those teachings that sometimes it's not obvious to the people who, and it's not pointed out. It's so inherent in his teachings that maybe it didn't really even occur to him to kind of highlight it in the way that that it's so important. And much of his teachings contains this principle, as if an obvious fact. So it involves a Pali word. The Pali word, the ancient Indian word, is kusala, K-U-S-U-L-A. And it's probably the best translation into English is skillfulness, to be skillful. And sometimes in the older translations into English, the word has been translated as wholesomeness, wholesome, and sometimes occasionally as good. And one relatively famous place where that word appears, most English translations don't have the word skillful in translation, so you wouldn't know. But there's a very pithy passage where the Buddha recites or teaches the kind of essential teachings. In a number of places he can find the core teachings in a few words. And in this particular one, it's a verse, and it goes, avoiding what's evil, doing what's skillful, purifying the mind. This is the teaching of the Buddhas. So these three things, avoiding evil, avoiding causing harm to yourself or to others. And then it's often translated as avoiding evil, then doing good. Now, doing good is a good thing to do, I suppose. But the word good is very vague. What does that mean? And how do you know? How do you decide what is good? And is it good for others? Is it good for oneself? Is it good in what way? And the word skillful perhaps is a little bit vague as well, because skillful implies usually some understanding, some goal, some purpose for which something is skillful for. But it's a little more specific than the vague good. And so the Buddha said to practice what's good, to develop what's skillful, and then to purify the mind. So the word skill is inherent, embedded in the Buddha's teachings, because the Buddha believed that human beings can become skillful. And we see that in many situations in human life where we're expected to develop skills. Most of you have learned how to drive your car. That's a skill. And probably, I imagine, none of you were born knowing how. And it's something you have to learn to do. I had to go to driver's ed in high school. And for which, when they were giving out the grades at the end, the teacher was reciting the grades to everyone, not reciting, but telling the grades. And it came to my name, he's paused. And he looked at me and looked at his grade. He couldn't believe it because I got an A. But the reason he couldn't believe it was I spent the whole class talking to my neighbor in class. I wasn't paying any attention. So that didn't need to be said, but we develop skill, and so we often admire people who develop a skill, athletes or musicians or artists or something. And sometimes we don't maybe appreciate how much time it took to develop that skill. I know I had a professor in graduate school who I admired a lot for her masterful articles she would write. And some of her just academic articles, and sometimes I'd read like mysteries. You'd kind of want to get to the end to find out what was going to happen. And beautiful articles. And I kind of assumed that they just came out of her just like that, one, two, three. And then one day she showed me a draft of one of her articles that she was writing. And there were all these pieces crossed out and moved. And I realized that for her, it was a craft. And it took a lot of skill. It took a lot of care and attention. And it wasn't just produced beautifully just like that, but rather it was something built up over time. And you worked the craft. And you developed skill in how to do it. So and now one of the implications of developing a skill, and one of the principles of it, is that your actions are consequential. That if you're practicing the skill, doesn't develop the skill, then why would you bother? So there's an inherent belief, maybe there's no proof, but there's an inherent belief that we have that if we keep practicing this over and over again, that we'll get better at it. And some things we have to just practice, you know, they say 10,000 times if you practice 10,000 hours of doing a musical instrument as a child really makes a big difference in real mastery as an adult. Kids who do 5,000 hours by the time they're 20 or something, it makes a big difference between those who do 10,000. Just the repetition over and over and over again makes a big difference in terms of mastery. So the idea that that you can make a difference, you can train yourself by repeated actions over and over again. Learn to ride a bike, the same thing. As we develop some skill, we refer to ourselves as developing mastery, meaning that we have some ability to master the event, to choose, to engage in it, and be successful in what we've had in mind. Many of us have mastered how to ride a bicycle, and maybe it took a little while, but then we master it. That's relatively easy, perhaps, compared to some, playing the classical music on the violin, which maybe takes a lot more time. So Buddhism and Buddhist practice has the same principle, that your actions are consequential, and what you do can make a difference. And if you apply yourself to develop a skill in meditation, for example, then you can develop the meditative mind. You can develop your capacity to get concentrated. You can develop your capacity to be mindful. You can develop your capacity to let go. You can there's a whole series of mental or inner qualities that can be developed, so that we don't have to be left with our native ability, get through life with just kind of whatever we're born with, but rather we can cultivate and train ourselves to a certain degree. The analogy I like for this is an interesting one, I think, is that of being thrown into a river. And perhaps you can know how to float. But you get thrown into the river, and all you know is how to float. And you trust the river. I just trust, and maybe the river is an analogy for life, I just trust life. I'll be taken care of. The river gods will take care of me. All I have to do is pray to the river gods and everything will be okay. And as long as the river is calm and smooth and the nice current going down, then you can be very happy and content and have a wonderful philosophy about how beautiful the river is, how the river has your best interest in mind, and it's all really wonderful until you come to the rapids. And so then, because you don't know anything about how to negotiate rapids, you're banged against the rocks. And so you're a victim of circumstances, in a sense, and then you blame the river gods for that. It's not up to you, and what a terrible river this is. This river is, really bad, it sucks, we should get out of it. So the same thing with life, we get tossed around by life and we feel a victim of it, and life sucks. And so that's not uncommon for people for whom life is really rough. Many people in the world, maybe a majority of them, life is really difficult and they don't see very little hope and possibility for their life and getting out of their dire circumstances, poverty and hunger and many things. And then it's very common for those people to then look for hope for their life in the next lifetime, because they don't see any possibility here. They're just, in a sense, victims of circumstances of this life. But if you develop a skill of how to negotiate the river, you understand. One skill is to learn how the river works. And you see that if you go away from the edges of the river, but in the middle, perhaps, when the river current's not too strong, you're not going to get snagged by the low-hanging branches and get stuck there, because you get caught by them. They cut your... Or you can see the rapids coming, and you can kind of discern, to go over those rapids, I need to go maybe more to the left. There's a little bit quieter over there. It's wider there, or it's not as rough there. Or you realize maybe you're better off going down feet first, which rather than sideways. And there's all kinds of things you can learn about how to paddle, how to move, and how to twist and turn. You can learn how to conserve your energy and how to apply it, how to swim this way and that way. And when you learn the skills of how to negotiate a river, then there's a certain mastery over it, then you're less inclined to either blame the river or less inclined to have this great philosophy about how the river guards are doing it or the river's all good or the river's all bad. You don't attribute the effect that's having on you on something that's external. You're much less. You're more likely to understand. The river does what it's doing. It's the river is carrying me along, so it certainly has its role, and I have to kind of float and know how to float in it all. But now I have skill. I have mastery over how to find this river, and so then I think the person then becomes disinclined to begin having lofty philosophies of either being a victim or being wonderfully supported by the river gods or whatever it might be. So the fact that we develop mastery or skill affects our relationship to the river, affects our relationship to life, affects our relationship to meditation. Buddhism puts a tremendous emphasis, traditional Buddhism, on developing these skills so we can become much more relaxed and capable and wise about how to get through this life. And it's sometimes not noticed by meditators who put the emphasis on having meditation experiences. If only I can have a particular experience, the Big Bang enlightenment experience, then everything will be happy ever. If only if I can get myself really calm, I won't be touched by anything. If only a certain way. But experiences are come and go. They're impermanent. Skills also are impermanent, but skills are more portable and enduring than experiences. And if you have a skill, so certain parts of the river, it's smooth and wonderful, but that's going to change down the line. So, in the rapids, it's not going to be so smooth and comfortable. But the skills you take with you, and you can carry it into life in all kinds of situations, and you can apply yourself the skills that are needed at a different time. So if you develop a range of skills, then you have more capacity to meet the particular situation you're in and not be troubled by it, not be caught up in it, not be victim of it, or not be, you have more balance. It's a lot easier to be calm. It's a lot easier to be relaxed if you feel some modicum of mastery over the situation. So what are the kinds of mastery that we can develop? Certainly we can develop street smarts and knowing how to negotiate particular things out there, ride a bike, for example, or know how to, find a job and work the job world or whatever it might be. We can learn these skills. But for Buddhism, the emphasis is, yes, do those things for sure, but develop mastery over your own mind so you can negotiate your own mind. So your own mind doesn't succumb to grief, doesn't succumb or become a victim of hate, doesn't become a victim of ambition or desire or addiction, doesn't get caught up in believing every possible thought that you can have. There's plenty of people who latch on to their thoughts, and the thoughts are not accurate, but then they limit their life. One common one is our identity of who we are. Or the conclusions we make about life, then we kind of, boom, lock in. But to develop skill in watching and seeing how the mind latches on to a belief, how it latches on to interpretation, and to be able to see an interpretation as interpretation is a very, very, very useful skill. Because if you see it as an interpretation and not the truth, you probably negotiate the situation much more wisely. You hold it lightly. You're willing to change your opinion if you get evidence otherwise. You're probably much more a compatible companion for other people because if you see it as interpretation, then maybe you're more willing to hear their perspective. But if it's their truth, by golly, they're going to have to believe it too. So these are all skills that we learn. And so meditation practice is a process of developing a certain degrees of skill. And the skill is primarily over our own mind, our own heart. And as we develop that, then we become less a victim of what our mind is capable of producing and doing. And so we can avoid falling into the rapids or being tossed around by the rapids in our own mind, in our own heart. But also we can start cultivating and developing the beautiful parts of the river. Beautiful parts of the river in the mind don't have to just arise out of chance. You know, if you wake up in the morning and you got up out of the wrong side of the bed and you feel lousy. You get up on the right side of the bed and you're floating on a cloud. You have no idea why. It's just because, who knows, you got a little extra sleep. I don't know. But if you develop mastery, some skill and capacity, then you know how to bring on some of the a calm state of being, or bring on a focused state, rather than being scattered and running all over. You say, okay, now I need to be much more usefully focused, I'll be much more productive. Let me kind of get more myself zeroed in on the task at hand, rather than, be caught up in all my concerns. Or how about if I'm going to meet with my friend, and I'm kind of grumpy. Maybe it's more useful when I'm with my friend who's in the hospital for me to show up and have a little bit more kindness, more goodwill for my friend. So can you just, can you call up goodwill? Is that a skill? Is that a capacity you have some mastery over? So you can develop a perspective, not artificially, but in a real way, where you're capable of bringing up compassion, loving kindness, a variety of different things, generosity in the right time. One of the most useful skills that we develop in meditation practice is a skill of letting go. And not necessarily letting go of things of the world. Sometimes we might want to do that. But learn how to let go of the things our mind holds on to, that grasps onto. And that's a muscle that can be developed, this muscle of letting go. If you haven't exercised that muscle, it's going to be rusty. It's going to be kind of awkward. You're not going to know how. There's a number of different skills that are needed, different understandings that are needed that come into play that help us to let go. And so the more we let go, the more we learn that skill, we negotiate that. And then with time, with that skill, when that skill becomes strong, then we can include wisdom as part of that skill. We can learn how, when it's wise to let go and when it's best not to let go, when it's skillful to let go and when it's not skillful to let go. So part of what Buddhism is involved in developing a skill. But then the word skill, kusala, is also used a little bit different way. And that is, we do that which is skillful, meaning that which is helpful or useful. So you develop skills, but you do that which is skillful. And skillful implies that you have some idea of a purpose, of what's useful, what's helpful. And so when you have some sense of a goal or a purpose or something that's valuable, then once you have the sense of what's valuable, then you can evaluate what helps me move in the direction of that valuable thing and what takes me away from it. So, for example, something can be very simple as I'm going to a job interview. And it would be useful, it would be skillful, when I go to the job interview, if I could be centered and calm. So you have two freeways to drive to get to the job interview. You could drive on 101 at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, or you can go down 280. And you've done this before, and you say, the way that I react to bumper traffic, and the way I react to, looking at the big meadows by the Stanford Dish, and the wildflowers are there right now, and I arrive at my job interview in a much better place by taking 280. And so it would then, because you want to be centered for the job interview, the skillful thing to do is to go 280, the relaxing freeway. So what are the things you can do that are skillful, that brings you peace, that brings you, develops your compassion, that creates a healthier life for you and for other people? And so emphasis that Buddhism has on ethics tends not to be moralistic. Thou shalt not kill. But rather the tendency is to look at it and say, killing other beings, stealing, lying, sexual misconduct, and intoxication, those activities are not skillful if what you want to do is to develop a peaceful heart. If what you want to do is have a heart or a mind which is not racked with remorse, racked with agitation, racked with conflict. You're much more likely to have conflict, to have remorse, to be upset, to be agitated, if you go around killing and stealing and lying. So if the standard for peace, the standard for being settled and at peace, is much higher for someone who meditates, because meditators can know a much higher, often can know a much higher degree of peace, of well-being, than someone who has never meditated. Never meditated, maybe occasionally you have that experience, maybe going, you know, into nature or, you know, certain kind of things you might kind of fall into. But in meditation, you realize that it isn't just an accident that you feel profound peace, but the profound peace you feel has something to do with how you conduct yourself. It's a skill. It's partly the result of being skillful and doing those things that are conducive for peace, and avoiding those things which make it hard to be peaceful. So being unethical makes it hard to have a settled, relaxed peace, to be at home in your own heart. To be ethical is a skillful thing to do for the purpose of being peaceful, for the purpose of creating a society around us which will be peaceful and harmonious. So the tendency in early Buddha, the teachings of the Buddha, is to have this, is to have some sense of a purpose, of our behavior, what's possible, some potential, and then having some sense of purpose, then looking at our behavior, and looking at two things: is what we're doing skillful or unskillful for that purpose, and what skills do I have to develop in order to attain that purpose. And then, as I said earlier, one of the primary skills we're developing, one of the primary places we're looking, is in our own minds. What are the activities of my mind which are conducive to the goal that I'm setting, spiritual liberation, peace, developing of compassion, being of service to the world, being settled? What are those which is conducive and what is not? You might discover, and it might be surprising to some people, maybe not none of you, that watching a lot of television is not particularly conducive. It might not come as an easy or obvious lesson to some people. Some people it's completely obvious, but drinking a lot of alcohol is not really in your best interest. And so it takes a while sometimes to get that message, but to realize it in your own experience. You know, this isn't really serving me. There's a higher good that I can experience. If I can do these certain things, there's a map, there's a path to practice that can lead me to states of well-being, states of feeling at ease, where alcohol is no longer necessary. It might be hard to get there, but there is a path. Now I think that for people who meditate, it can be helpful to look at their minds and look at their meditation from the perspective of developing a skill, from the perspective of looking at what is skillful and what's going on here. And one of the first skills that's helpful for meditation is the skill of self-monitoring, of actually noticing carefully what is actually happening when you're sitting and meditating. So, for example, to notice, here's an interesting skill or a skillful observation to make, is to notice the different kinds of thinking that go on in your mind. Thinking isn't just like one level of intensity, one degree, one level of kind of thinking going on all the time. There are different levels of thought that goes on in our mind. If you're agitated and upset, it might be very loud conversations you have in your mind, justifying yourself. I remember once doing something which wasn't exactly wrong, but went against what the group I was involved in was a status quo, and it was very challenging for me to step out of what my group was doing, and go off on my own way, And so I spent 6 months in my mind having these very active conversations with the people I left behind, justifying why I left. And these were big debates. And so, you know, they were, you know, relatively coarse. Or if you've ever been lost in the woods, and, you know, the mind kind of begins, sometimes, you know, at least for me it happened once, I was racing very fast, trying to figure out what was going on. And then I finally was found, I mean, I found myself, and I sat down, and immediately the mind got quiet. And I still was thinking, but it was, you know, quite a big difference between how loud the thoughts were when I was lost and how calmer they got when I knew that I was safe. When I sit down to meditate, and I've had a kind of a full day or something, one of the first experiences I have when I sit down to meditate, maybe because I've done this for a long time, is kind of a similar to the experience perhaps of being in an auditorium for some big event, and before it all starts, everyone's talking, and it's a big, a lot of talking going on, but then there's a bell or the lights dim or something, and everyone gets quiet. So for me, when I sit down to meditate, relatively quickly, the audience gets quiet. And it's just, it's quiet. But I don't stop thinking. But the thinking has now become subtler and quieter. And one of the things that happens is I tend not to have conversations anymore, which is what in Buddhism is, or in our circle sometimes is called discursive thinking, where you're actually having conversations, you're explaining, you're reviewing, you're memorizing, you're remembering the past, you're planning the future. It's much more active, like you're having a conversation. That level of discursive thinking quiets down. And so I know that there's another level of thinking which is much more quiet, more spacious, more relaxed, more open. It doesn't have as many tentacles into my muscles, into my energy, into preoccupation. So it's a kind of thinking that doesn't cause stress or tension. And it just kind of, and sometimes it's a very simple observation, thoughts of observation, recognizing what's happening right here now. Oh, here, my shoulder is a little bit tense, maybe from a lot of other thinking going on. And it, you know, the fact that the audience has quieted down doesn't mean the effect of the audience doesn't linger. So I say, oh, there's tension in my shoulders. So I'm not troubled by that. I don't try to do anything about it, but I simply recognize it. And that simple recognition keeps me in the present moment. I might notice when the conversations begin. And there's a very simple, relaxed awareness. Oh, here I start the conversations. I don't have to do that. And I let go. And so the capacity to see the difference between these two different kinds of levels of thinking makes it easier for a person to know that one is useful and one is not. If we haven't distinguished between those two, and you think the only game in town is thinking, why would you give it up? You know, maybe it even never occurred to you that you could change what you know. And giving up thinking as a whole, like I'm meditating, I'm not supposed to have any thought whatsoever. That's generally a much too high standard. And you probably get disappointed pretty quickly. But maybe what you can do is to realize that there's layers of thinking, or levels of thinking, and some of the coarser levels, perhaps you can quiet those down. And put your energy, in a sense, encouraging those quieter ones. Because if you encourage the quieter, more peaceful kinds of way of thinking, there's less of the energy is going to go back into the conversations. So that's developing a skill. Another skill that, one more I mention, is the skill of watching, monitoring yourself, and knowing when you're trying too hard, when you're manipulating, when you've heard these teachings about being skillful, and you're just trying too hard to kind of like, you know, accomplish everything and get somewhere and be the one who's skillful, the one who's trying to be successful, and you tie yourself in knots with all your effort. And perhaps the skill you need to learn is not how to do, but the skill of not doing. And a lot of people spend much too much time doing and accomplishing and proving themselves and defending themselves and, you know, trying to get blissful states or whatever. And perhaps the most useful skill for a while is to not do anything. And just let go of doing, let go of doing, let go of doing. And something profound can happen within us when we just kind of do nothing for a while. And then at some point, when you've learned not to do long enough and discovered a kind of well-being or peace that comes from not doing, then perhaps you're ready to do. to do the things that are more skillful and negotiate the rapids, negotiate further down, or become, you know, you learn that you're flailing around in the river doesn't help you. So you know how to float. So the best thing to do is to learn just to float, because the alternative, all you know is flailing, doesn't work. But once you've really learned how to float well, then you learn, you know, if I just kind of, you know, paddle just gently to my left, it seems like it puts me into the more smooth current in the river, or the warmer current in the river, and it's really a delight to be there. And then I can look ahead and I say, oh, if I just paddle a little bit to the left, I can avoid those dangers. So for some people who need to learn how to let go a lot first and not do first, eventually they learn that they can start adding the paddling. And the deeper dimensions of liberation that Buddhism teaches requires a negotiation of finding the right balance between doing and not doing. And for the deepest potentials of what Buddhism points to, at some point the last of the doing that we do that's skillful is the functioning of activity of knowing, of simply knowing, being mindful, being aware of what's happening, a pristine, kind of beautiful, peaceful, relaxed knowing. It is a kind of a doing. It's different than just being. It's a little bit more active, but it's a knowing what's going on. And that very simple knowing helps the mind to go deeper and deeper and deeper until finally you come to the end of what knowing can possibly do. And then the mind will know when to let go of that last doing, the doing of knowing. And what happens when the knowingness of the mind falls away, drops away, is one of the most profound things that can happen to a human being. For instance, in Buddhism, that's kind of where the experience of awakening or liberation occurs. And so in the teachings of the Buddha, for him, he wasn't interested in helping people be more skillful in a job interview. He was kind of renunciant. He had devoted his life to discovering the greatest potential that human being is capable of experiencing, the greatest degree of liberation from suffering, the profoundest degrees of peace and compassion that a person can experience. And he wasn't kind of interesting in, you know, half measures. Or, you know, he didn't have any other interests. Like, he wasn't interested in the job thing, right? So he could really focus on that one thing. And so for him, when he talked about skillfulness, doing what's skillful, it was primarily in reference to what helps, what's skillful for experiencing liberation, for attaining liberation or awakening. And so almost all of the Buddha's teachings have that as its purpose. He, as far as I could tell, there was no requirement that anyone follow that path. There was no moral imperative. You'll only be a good person if you follow this path of liberation that Buddha taught. It's completely voluntary. It's completely optional. You're welcome to go for your job interview and do something else. And I think the Buddha had that kind of offered, as far as I could tell, offered his teachings in that kind of open-handed way. Look, there's no requirement here. No one's telling you have to do this. But if you're interested in what I have to teach, if you want this, it requires something of you. And it requires of you that you avoid the kind of things which go in the opposite direction. If you want to learn to swim, you don't spend all your time in the desert, where there's no water, I suppose. I don't. Maybe there's some way you can figure out how that helps you swim, but you know, you have to, you know, find yourself near the water at some point. So if you want to develop the awakening of the Buddha, you need to stop doing the things that go in the opposite direction, and not necessarily because they're bad, not necessarily because Buddhism says these things are, you know, immoral. Some of them might be just fine things to do, but they're not helpful for that purpose. If you're not interested in the purpose of awakening, then by all means, if you're not harming anybody else, that's okay, you know, it's fine to do those things. So Buddhism tends not to be moralistic, but tends to be pragmatic or theological or you know, voluntary. And asks of you then if you're if you want something, it requires something of you, and it's up to you to decide whether you want to follow through on those things. So the cultivation of skill, and the important, that word is so important in the early tradition. It's kind of it's embedded throughout the teachings. If you start reading those texts, you'll see the word skill. Sometimes you see the word wholesomeness appear in the earlier translations. And I don't think word wholesomeness is a good translation, because it kind of implies something moralistic. It kind of lends itself in that direction. And the Buddha, but for the Buddha, it was kusala, which meant skill. So how's that? We have 2 minutes for protests, skillful protests, or questions. One of the interesting things they say in Buddhism that it's always skillful to ask questions. So, yeah, anybody wants to say a couple of minutes before we go? Yes, please. If you can.
It seems that we have to, as householders, we have to be skillful in many areas, both on the job or as participating in a family. Those skills are all enhanced, of course, by being mindful. But the Buddha at least brings up right speech. And of course, you can even say right listening. As a business owner, I find that right listening is probably one skill I need the most.
Yes.
And anyway, seems all to fit together. Yes. And as householders, I always like to think every once in a while we have a few monks. And I think, no, we've got the rougher road. We have to have lots of skills to be helpful.
In some ways, it's rougher. Part of the reason for monastic life is not because it's a more necessarily more virtuous life or anything like that, but it tends to be easier. It doesn't have much fewer complications. However, the disadvantage of it is that there are fewer complications. and what I mean by this is that. I know plenty of monastics, including my own time as a monastic, where I thought things were great. I got this down. I can get concentrated, I can let go, this is pretty good. I'm hot stuff. And then I got into my family thing, and I realized, only then did I realize, I have more work to do. There's more things to develop and learn here, and I'm really grateful for that. And I feel it's been a powerful monastery. It's been a powerful teacher for me to be in family, to to be in community and many things. And so, the theory is that monastic life is the easier, more pleasant way of doing this work, and maybe it is for some people, for some individuals. I think that actually the household life. Sometimes if they really do it well and sincerely is sometimes a very powerful way of doing this work as well. A lot of the Buddha's teachings can apply directly to how to live a household work life in a skillful way, not necessarily become more awake, but to create the conditions for harmony and happiness and well-being for everyone concerned. And it's skillful to get enough sleep. That's considered a very skillful thing to do. So with that, perhaps we should end. Thank you.